The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And today's the day we break the cover in a brand new edition of Our State magazine celebrating North Carolina. This one for September 2020. Do you believe we're there already? Stories from the Open Road is the theme song this month. And there's this must be Highway 12. Yes, it is. It says a North Carolina highway tradition. Cruising North Carolina Highway 12, top down, sun shining above, and endless adventures ahead. This is out on Dare County, the Outer Banks. They've got a two-lane road with a breakdown lane, which isn't really big enough to break down on. In fact, you can see car tracks in the sand outside the breakdown lane. But here's somebody lucky enough to have a convertible on a beautiful day. There's a grassy land on the left and the power lines set back from the road some way. And then dunes on the right, and on the other side of the dunes, a glimpse of the ocean. We're going to begin, as we always do, the first reading of the month with the From Elizabeth column by Elizabeth Hudson, editor-in-chief. She titles this one, School of Thought. We thought it was a privilege to get tapped on the shoulder by the teacher and then handed those dusty, dry, dirty chalkboard erasers. Two of us were chosen, then sent outside to clap the erasers clean, which we did by pounding them with all our third-grade might against the red brick wall of the school building, pummeling out rectangular smudges of powder, leaving ghost tracings on the wall, plumes of pulverized chalk clouding the air, coating our hands. It was an honor to be called up to the board, to write out a spelling word, to work out a math problem, or, before the last bell, to be part of the team that got to wash down the chalkboard, plunging a rag into a bucket of water to wipe away the remnants of the day in preparation to start tomorrow fresh. The chalkboard was the focal point of the class, the canvas on which everything meaningful was laid out for us. A penmanship chart mounted just above it reminded us how to form a perfect cursive curl at the top of a capital D or a T. A daily tally in the corner of the board told us who had sold the most world's finest chocolate bars. A name with a check mark noted who among us was talking too much. We were riveted to it every day, its place in the hierarchy of importance, second only to the American flag, hanging from a pole in the corner and to which we pledged allegiance every morning. When I wasn't in school, I played school, retreating to my room with my own chalkboard on a folding wooden easel. Store-bought chalk was never as smooth as school chalk. There was a grittiness to my Crayola chalk, but it didn't stop me from carefully forming my name in the corner, Miss Hudson, and assigning lessons to my attentive, if eclectic, class of students, Mrs. Beasley, Holly Hobby, Stretch Armstrong, Ballerina Barbie. Eventually, my chalkboard migrated to the bedroom closet, along with my dolls, and then to the attic, and then out of the house altogether, a clean removal, an inevitable cleaning away. After my school years, I didn't think about chalkboards anymore, schoolroom relics supplanted by other mediums of communication, loose-leaf notebook paper and spiral notebooks, then word processors, and finally thin laptops and phones that fit in our palms. Handheld modern slates for taking notes, typing messages, recording our days, our lives. And then, several years ago, I came home from work to find that my dad had been at my house, where he'd built and bolted onto my fence a chalkboard, 5 feet wide by 3 feet tall, a wooden frame around it that he'd painted a tranquil turquoise. It was such a surprise, a gift I hadn't even known I'd wanted. He'd written "Love, Dad" on it, a message that has long since been erased by wind and rain, but I still know that it was there. The chalkboard went with me when I moved to my townhouse. It's affixed to my patio fence now, where I can see it from my window. Every week I write a new message, quotes from writers I like, poems, itineraries I want to take, messages visible only to me and to the birds, and to the open air, the skies, and the heaven. And now to the accompaniment of some music again this month. I forgot it last month. We're going to interpret the photo essay for you on page 90 of the September 2020 edition of our state magazine. This one's entitled Retro Mountain Magic. Two classic theme parks, Land of Oz and Beach Mountain and Tweetsie Railroad in Blowing Rock, hold fond memories of growing up in North Carolina. Written by Katie St. Singh. On the left, feet of a young lady, white socks, bright red shoes. Let's see, what do you call that stuff? Sequins, red sequins all over the shoes. And on the right, an engine, train engine. Staff members at Land of Oz knew they'd found the perfect shade of paint when they saw how a pair of ruby slippers looked against the yellow brick road that I just described without telling you it was on the yellow brick road. East of Oz, engine number 12 has carried passengers since Tweetsie Railroad opened in 1957. So this is a close-up of the front end of the Tweetsie Railroad, number 12. It's a big old black finish engine with a red number 12 emblem. And the 12, of course, is stamped right in the middle of the round circle and some gold rims. And I suppose it says Tweetsie Railroad around the edge. I can't read it. It's a little small. The cow catcher, you know what that is? That thing on the front that scoops a cow up and throws it off the track if it happens to be there, is all painted red. And there's a I can't tell whether it's a yellow. I guess it's yellow. It looks like brass. So it's either brass or a yellow paint bar right above it that someone could hang on to if they were standing there, I guess. And then the rest of the engine goes back, and you can see a black tube sticking up in the air. That would be what they forced the water into the boiler with. And there's some people wandering out of the station, coming over to probably the area where they're going to be getting on the train. But first, we're going to talk about the Land of Oz in Beach Mountain. Land of Oz creators hoped that Judy Garland would cut the ribbon, but she died the summer before the park opened. To honor her memory, they built a gazebo looking out over the sweeping Elk Valley. So what we have here is we have the Land of Oz buildings are perched on a fairly flat peak that is heavily wooded, and then the mountain just drops off into this valley, and everything beyond that is a purplish haze. And in the far distance, you can see some hazy clouds outlined against a faintly blue sky. And the text on this page says, "Over the rainbow, In the warm months, the once snowy slopes of Beech Mountain turn green. The hardy trees that thrive at 5,506 feet, leafing out to cocoon a magical place at the top of the mountain. The Land of Oz. More than 50 years ago, Grover Robbins, one of the developers who started Beech Mountain Resort, hired Jack Pentes, an artist from Charlotte, to design a theme park that would draw visitors year-round. Not just during ski season. The two men drove to the peak, and then, Pentes said in a 1971 program, the trees grabbed me, those beautiful trees that couldn't be anywhere else, except for the feeling that I'd seen them before. They continued to explore until Pentes realized, this is the Land of Oz. It was the only idea Robbins needed to hear. When the park was completed in 1970, it harmonized with nature just as Pentes had envisioned, lying cradled within the land on Beech Mountain, as if the Land of Oz had always been there. Overleaf, no place like home. In 1970, Land of Oz opened to great fanfare. Actress Debbie Reynolds and a 13-year-old Carrie Fisher attended the grand opening to cut the ribbon. And that first season, 400,000 visitors rode up Beech Mountain by bus or ski lift. At the top, they followed a path to the woods to Uncle Henry and Aunt Em's farmhouse, exploring rooms carefully decorated to look like a turn-of-the-century Kansas home. But then they descended into the storm cellar. The furniture began to shake. The wind kicked up, and psychedelic colors swirled as the house was swept up in a tornado. On the other side of the cellar corridor, visitors emerged, slightly dazed, to find a mirror image of the rooms they'd just passed through. Only this time, the floors tilted at a 15-degree angle, artwork hung askew, and doors were blown from their hinges. Those visitors surely weren't at Beech Mountain anymore. Just beyond the back door lay the yellow brick. And here's a photo. It says, after Dorothy's house crash lands in Oz, the once tidy rooms are thrown into disarray, and the sloping floors usher visitors to their next part of their adventure. And here is a woman wearing a Land of Oz shirt, and she's accompanied by a friend of about the same age, up there somewhere, and they have nervous looks on their faces because the floor is tilted. There's a big crack in the wall, and there's a picture hanging off the wall at a really odd angle, and a light fixture is all messed up. Wonder Wizardry. Designer Jack Pentes carefully considered each element of the park, even crawling through on his knees to see it from a child's perspective. Along the yellow brick road, he planned stops where visitors could meet the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Wicked Witch of the West. Colorful toadstools sprouted from Munchkin Land, and a chairlift ride designed to look like hot air balloons circled the park. But real life soon intruded. In 1975, the company that owned the park went bankrupt. Later that year, vandals set fire to the Emerald City and burglarized the on-site museum that held costumes from the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz. Although the park's new owners rebuilt, Land of Oz was never the same, and in 1980, it closed its gates. Caption, at last year's Autumn at Oz event, Vanessa Schilling played the Wicked Witch of the West, and here she is all dressed in black with her pointed hat, and she's got some makeup on that makes her chin look exceptionally pointed, and her cheeks are puffed out, and she's carrying a broomstick. Kay Harkins, on the opposite page, was an original Dorothy who met her husband, the Tin Man, working at Land of Oz in the 70s. Now they play Glinda the Good Witch and Professor Marvel, respectively, and their daughter plays Dorothy. She's over here, all dressed in white, of course, with silver stars and little balls attached to her outfit. She's got her arms outstretched, and she has a wand with a star at the top of it in sequins and a tall, white, good witch's hat. Return to Oz. In the decades after it closed, Land of Oz became something of a myth and a mystery, but its story wasn't over. A reunion of the original cast members in the mid-90s evolved into a public event called Autumn at Oz, which sells out quickly every September and continues to grow. The cast alone comprises 68 people, including six Dorothys a day, like Morgan White on the opposite page, ensuring that everyone has a chance to see her skip down the yellow brick road. Attendees are often overwhelmed with nostalgia, says artistic director Sean Barrett, who's seen full-grown adults burst into tears. It speaks volumes about the park, he says, but also about the Wizard of Oz. We have four photos on the left. It says, "Let Professor Marvel read your fortune." And that would be referring to the photo in the upper left. We see an old wagon with those great big wheels that the wagons used to have, and the side of it has boards on it that are very light colored and in brown print, backed by white for highlighting. It says, "Professor Marvel, acclaimed by the crowned heads of Europe, past, present, and future." And then it's other things like juggling and sleight of hand and in his crystal. They're also going to explore the yellow brick road, and here it is. It's yellow bricks wending their way through the overgrowth. It really is very nicely painted yellow, maybe refreshed every year, and has a little granite blocks on either side to separate it from the grass. Explore Munchkin Land and spot a flying monkey, played by Ren Lewis. And here's the monkey. He's not flying, but he's running along the ground. It looks like he has some NC State colors on. Maybe he's an NC State student. I don't know. And there's a little green house in Munchkin Land with a very small door. And Dorothy's skipping down the road carrying her basket on the right-hand page. The Memory Keepers. Barrett and the rest of the staff work hard to get the details just right. Every year before the park opens for private tours beginning in June, they volunteer to touch up the paint on the 44,000 brick yellow brick road. Before Autumn at Oz, they fill in the corn stalks around Dorothy's house and place 4,000 poppies along the yellow brick road leading up to the Emerald City gates, shown on the opposite page. Everyone takes the job seriously, Barrett says. We feel a responsibility to keep the park going. Many original cast members from the 70s, then called Aussies, return to the park to help out year after year, bonded by their passion for Oz. Here's the Emerald City gates. What color do you think they are? Emerald City, get it? Emerald green, of course. And they have boards on them that are placed to look, well, at first glance, just like supporting boards for the vertical boards, but they actually form the letters O and Z. And the yellow brick road ends right at the door. And on the right-hand side, when the gatekeeper of Emerald City, played by Scott Loveless, pokes his head out, Wizard of Oz fans recite his line in unison with him. "Who rang that bell?" He has big handlebar mustache. He's bald-headed, and he has this green outfit with a big hood that's flapped up behind his head. Off to see the wizard. During the park's original run, a visit to Land of Oz culminated with the Magic Moments stage show in Emerald City, with music by the composer Lunas McLowan and choreography by Alice Lamar, both Shalitians. The old Emerald City and its amphitheater are gone now, but during Autumn at Oz, the wizard, Jeff Dreyer, far left, once again gets a visit from Dorothy, Brittany Sue Hines, and her friends. Together, they discover what they had all along, smarts and courage, heart and home. And here they are all lined up. We have the wizard. He has gray striped pants, a green vest, a black overcoat. He's pretty much balding, and he has a salt and pepper beard. And here's Dorothy looking very nervous, holding her little dog Toto there and a basket on her other arm. Her long, curly, brunette hair cascading down over her. And then we have, obviously, the Scarecrow. You can tell how I can figure that out. And the Tin Man. Can you think how I could tell that out? And the Cowardly Lion, who's holding his tail in his hand. And then we move on to Tweetsie Railroad at Blowing Rock. Riding the rails with cowboys like Harlow, shown here, has been a rite of passage for North Carolina kids for more than half a century. Yet the Tweetsie tradition stretches back even further to the late 19th century when the East Tennessee and Western North Carolina Railroad cut a steep and rugged route through the Blue Ridge Mountains. Beginning in 1882, the railroad locomotives hauled iron ore from the mines in Cranberry in Avery County to Johnson City, Tennessee. By 1919, passenger service extended to Boone. The railroad was a lifeline for residents of remote western North Carolina, and it earned the name Tweetsie for the comforting trill of its steam engine's whistle. But as roads reached many of the formerly isolated communities that had once relied on Tweetsie, cars and trucks supplanted the trains, and in 1950, the railroad closed its tracks. More than a century old, engine number 12, the last surviving steam locomotive of the East Tennessee and Western North Carolina Railroad, which ran between Boone and Johnson City, Tennessee, still exists. Here it is, riding on trestles. And it says 12, Tweetsie, and Tweetsie RR on the cab, and Tweetsie RR on the green coal-carrying car directly behind the locomotive, and then the red Tweetsie Railroad car itself. It says Tweetsie Railroad in yellow letters on the side and has their logo, and you can see all the passengers through the open windows. A nice shot here over the trestle. Riding high. After the railroad shuttered, its sole surviving steam engine embarked on a new journey. Engine number 12 had a brief stint as a tourist attraction in Virginia before it was purchased by actor Gene Autry, who planned to use it in Western films. When that didn't work out, Grover Robbins, the entrepreneur who would go on to develop Beach Mountain and open Land of Oz, saw an opportunity. He bought the locomotive from Autry for... How much do you think the locomotive sold for? This is unbelievable. $1, and brought it home to North Carolina and began to build a theme park around it, the first in the state. Can you imagine what that's worth today? He bought it for $1. And here is a doubles page spread. These are little, what do you call these things? They're like the things the skiers go on an overhead lift line. It says Tweetsie's amusement rides include the chairlift, that's the name I'm looking for, to Miner's Mountain, which offers scenic views as visitors float peacefully over the park. This is a shot right at one of the stanchions where you find the rollers going over the top. The people are looking down. They have a bar, of course, in front of them that they're hanging on to keep from tumbling out. You can see the launching station behind them, and they're on their way up. And behind them, you can see a carnival-like amusement ride, which swings people around at about a 45-degree angle. Still chugging. When Tweetsie Railroad opened on July 4, 1957, its appeal was simple. Visitors rode engine number 12 to a picnic area a mile away, ate lunch, and rode back. Soon the mile-long track became a three-mile loop, one train became two, and Robin's Wild West theme park began to take shape. Over the years, Tweetsie has grown to include live shows and amusement rides, gem mining, and a petting zoo, but it still feels small and welcoming. It's still designed for and owned by family. And thanks to Robbins and his relatives, the unmistakable whistle of a train called Tweetsie still echoes across generations. For more information, you can visit Tweetsie.com, and Tweetsie ends I-E, not with a Y. Tweetsie.com. Here's the final photos. Parents who grew up visiting Tweetsie Railroad return with their own children for rides, games, and chocolate-covered cherries served up by Tom Livingston below at Tweetsie's Fudge Works. So here's the main building. Boy, it is in good shape. It's got maroon-colored siding on it, a big clock. This was taken at exactly 1 o'clock. It's got three flags, not over Fuquay, but over Tweetsie. Big green sign with yellow or gold letters says Tweetsie Railroad Entrance. And down below is Mr. Tom Livingston at the Fudge Works. He has a tray that is just full of fudge balls, and each one has a little toothpick in it so that we may help ourselves. And finally, here's some kids and a dad waiting to be next to go through that sign that says enter to get on the carousel. Well, we are almost through our magazine for the day, so we don't really have time to read another article. So I might mention this page. It says North Carolina Coast Host, from beaches to historic towns, from battleships to wineries. It's all here. Shouldn't you be? Explore nccoast.com and discover your new vacation paradise. And here are some suggestions. History on Hooves, North Carolina's state horse, the foundation for Shackleford horses, preserving and protecting the Shackleford Banks wild horses for future generations. You can find them at www.shackleford-horses.org. The 32nd annual with Topsail is October 16th to 18th, 2020. And it is sponsored by the Historical Society of Topsail Island, juried artists, crafts courts, live music, food, beer, and wine, autumnwithtopsail.com. You can also see visitpender.com and learn more about Pender County, North Carolina. How about the Outer Banks Oceanfront, Kitty Hawk and Nag's Head? They have a Hilton Garden Inn and a Ramada Plaza. Swansboro, great place, love it. Accommodations, waterfront dining, shopping, outdoor fun, festivals, and more. Visit swansboronc.org. Or escape to the less crowded days of summer at Holden Beach, North Carolina. Alan Holden Vacations at www.holden-beach.com. And remember, lower off-season rates are available. Surf City, North Carolina. www.surfcitync.gov will tell you about it. Oriental, do love Oriental, where simple pleasures fill your days. www.towndoc.net, and you know at towndoc.net they have like 5 camera views of the water out there, so you can always learn what's going on. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. No fly-by-night they are. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.